So our last lecture together, we'll discuss two topics. The first will be a continuation of what we did yesterday. So just as a brief recap of what we did yesterday. So yesterday, we defined what an asymptotic series was. So an asymptotic series is one in which if we take a fixed number of terms and we take our expansion parameter to some closer to some limit point, often in 0 or infinity, then we get a better and better approximation. And I claim that we often get asymptotic series if we switch sums and integrals. So we can take an expression for something we're interested in, say an integral that we massage to look like a Gaussian, then we can approximate it, and what we'll get is an asymptotic series, not a convergent series in general. And we saw a general method for constructing asymptotic series or asymptotic relations, assuming we start with an integral expression for the object we're interested in approximating. And so in the first part of today's lecture, we will look at a slightly more general case than the cases we talked about yesterday, where we allow our expansion parameter to have a phase in the complex plane. And this will lead to something called Stokes phenomenon, where the asymptotic relations change depending on the phase of our expansion parameter. And then in the last part of lecture, we'll discuss some methods for summing divergent series. So many of the asymptotic series we've encountered in lecture and in tutorial are divergent. They don't converge. These sums don't converge for any fixed value of our expansion parameter. But there's a sense in which we can assign finite numbers to divergent series. And this is a useful thing to do and a consistent thing to do. We don't do that by just summing the terms in the series. But nevertheless, there is a meaning we can assign to divergent series, a finite number we can assign to divergent series. And that's what we'll discuss in the second part of lecture. Any questions from yesterday before we start? OK. So begin with Stokes phenomena. And so Stokes phenomenon refers to the fact that asymptotic relations often depend on the phase or argument of the expansion parameter. Okay, and we're going to illustrate this by example, like we did the saddle point method. And so the example we'll focus on is this integral. And we'll be interested in approximating this integral as z goes to infinity. And for now we'll assume z is real. We'll let z go to infinity at some angle in the complex plane later. But for now, we'll first assume it's real. And here, t is real. So this almost looks like it's in the form we saw yesterday. We've got this exponential part and a prefactor. This exponential part is clearly biggest if t is 0. So you might just say, we can neglect this cosine. T is 0, this cosine is just 1. And we get something like this. Which is just the Gaussian integral. This isn't correct. Does anyone see why? Is this in the same form as we saw yesterday?
The limits of the integral?
The limits of the integral are different, yes. That's true. And that will become important. There's another difference as well.
The variables are in both. There's two variables in the argument of E and in the function.
That's right, right. So here we've got, before our prefactor was independent of our expansion parameter, and that was crucial in our argument, because we could basically just ignore the prefactor for the whole time. And we only thought about that really in the last few steps when we were talking about the saddle point approximation. Here our expansion parameter is in this prefactor. And that means that we can't just use the method we had before. And to see more concretely what's the problem, so this exponential is only exponentially small if t is greater than 1 over the square root of z. But if t is, so if t is approximately 1 over the square root of z, then this will be exponentially, will just be like e to the minus 4. And over here, the argument of the cosine will be large. So the cosine will be oscillating, and we'll get some destructive interference. So this argument doesn't work. So in order to use the methods we talked about yesterday, we need to first manipulate this integral and put it in the form where we've got our expansion parameter only appears in the exponent. Here we get destructive interference. And once we do that, we'll see that, as was pointed out, the endpoints will play an important role. OK. So in order to use the saddle point approximation, we want to put our expansion parameter in the exponent. And we can do that by noting that our integral is the real part of the integral from 0 to 1 dt to the minus 4 zt squared plus 5 iz t minus iz t cubed. So the real part, we'll just pick out the cosine here. And we can rewrite this again, noting that if we extend the range of the integral from minus 1 to 1, we don't need to take the real part because the I sine part will be an odd integral over from minus 1 to 1. So we can just write this as half of the integral of the same thing from minus 1 to 1. And cosine is even, so we'll get the same thing from minus 1 to 0 and 0 to 1. And it'll be useful. We can write this in a slightly different way. Write this as minus e to the minus 2z integral from minus 1 to 1 dt e to the z rho of t, where rho of t is minus t minus I squared minus I t minus I cubed. So if we expand this out, we'll get exactly these terms plus a 2z, which will cancel out here. This step is not essential. Rewriting this polynomial in terms of this polynomial, but it will slightly simplify the algebra later. So I'll just do that. Okay. So now what we've accomplished is we put this integral in the same form we had yesterday. It's now our expansion parameter is only in the exponent. So the strategy we followed yesterday is we then want to, and the strategy you followed in the tutorial is we then want to find the saddle points and deform our contour so that it passes through the saddle points, and then we can apply the saddle point method from lecture yesterday. So let's do that. And when we do that, we'll find that there's a new complication from the endpoints. And so we'll have to take into account the endpoints of the contours. But first, let's note that if we want to pass through the saddle points are where rho prime t is 0. And this occurs at t equals I and t equals 5i over 3. So we just take a derivative. Should be clear, there's one at I. Because both of these have at least two factors at t minus I. And the other one is at 5i over 3. Okay. So let's start by drawing a picture of what we've got going on here. So here's the imaginary part of t. Here is the real part of t. And our contour goes along the real line from minus 1 to 1. So this is our original contour. And we've got saddle points here and here. 5i. So we need to find a way in order to deform this contour so it passes through these saddle points. And the safest way to apply the method to deform the contour is to keep our contours, to deform our contours so that they're contours of constant phase. Yesterday we were worrying a lot about whether we would get destructive interference if the phase of the integrand was changing. So if we keep our, if our contours have constant phases the entire, along the entire contour, then we'll never have destructive interference. And the analysis is much simpler. We won't run into problems like we did up there. So our strategy is going to be we're going to try to deform this contour into these into contours that pass through one or both of these saddle points, and we'll try to make our contours have constant phase. So if the integrand has a constant phase, that means that the imaginary part of rho has a constant imaginary part, or it's the imaginary part of rho is constant. So we want constant phase contours means constant imaginary part of rho. And the imaginary part of rho is, if we write, we take t equals u plus iv, then the imaginary part of rho is 3u v squared minus 8uv plus 5u minus u cubed. And the phase at the endpoints is different. So the imaginary part of rho of minus 1, we plug that in here. We just have v equals 0. So we get minus 5 plus 1, get minus 4. And similarly, for the other endpoint, we have 5 minus 1 is 4. So we have the phase of the integrand is different at the two endpoints. So we can't connect the endpoints together with a constant phase contour unless we first go to infinity. And we can sketch out the constant phase contours. So the constant phase contour for that passes through this endpoint will look like this. And the real part of rho will decrease in this direction. So it goes, it decreases. So this way is, the arrows are pointing to smaller real part of rho. And similarly for the other constant phase contour will look like this. These are constant phase contours. Okay. So we want to connect together. We want to construct a contour that's equivalent to our original contour. Sorry. I've drawn them slightly differently. So here the arrows do point to smaller rho, but I'm going to draw it there. Okay, so. And on this side, they should go the other way. Let me just draw arrows in a different color that point to smaller real parts of rho, and down here is smaller real part of rho. So using just these two constant phase contours, we're not there's no way to connect these two together to get something that is equivalent to our original contour that goes through one of the saddle points. But if we also plot the constant phase contours that pass through our saddle points, we'll find that one constant phase contours that go through this saddle point look like this. And through this saddle point, constant phase contour looks like this. So we can construct a contour that's equivalent to our original contour. If we just start from minus 1, go along this constant phase contour to infinity, come back along the constant phase contour that passes through this saddle point, go back to infinity over here, and then come back this way to the other endpoint.
So creepy.
Is that, yes, question.
When you go all the way down to infinity along the constant phase contour that passes through I, isn't that phase changing when you jump from one of those contours to the other? Like, why is it okay to do that?
It is, but the real part of rho is decreasing, so our integrand is negligibly small. The farther down we go, the smaller the integrand. We can make those jumps and without worrying about anything.
Is there like any requirement, like the two contours have to decrease with the same speed, or?
They should like be approach each other as.
Okay, so it should be equivalent.
Equivalent. That's right. Did you have a question?
And just the shape of the constant phase contours to minus 1 and 1.
Minus 1 and 1. So what the shape is determined by basically the contours, we look at the contours where the imaginary part of rho is constant. So doing it, figuring out the shape of these analytically, we'd have to look at how we could figure out how U would depend on V so that this is constant. It's also very easy to do in mathematical, just plot the constant contours of this function.
Direction of going to smaller real row.
So we could again write down a an equation for the real part of row in terms of u and v, and then we could just evaluate that along these curves. So I'd Showing that the curves have this precise shape, it's easiest to do, and it's really easy to do in Mathematica. Doing it analytically would take a while. So, yes.
Then you have like a direction for smaller real part of be coincident in the two contours, like the one that goes through one and the one that goes through I in the infinity. They should both be getting smaller and smaller real part. No?
Over here, we go to smaller real part of row in this direction and in this direction, and larger real part in this.
The arrow does.
These purple arrows indicate the smaller, the direction of the smaller real part of row.
And the other arrow.
The white arrows indicate the direction. So our original contour is this yellow line. Our new contour is the white lines going in the direction of the white arrows. Okay. So once, is everyone okay with this picture first? Any more questions? So once we've deformed our contour into these three constant phase contours, and we're free to do that because this function is analytic. There's no poles, so we don't have to worry about poles like you did in tutorial yesterday. Then we can apply the saddle point method. And so we can just evaluate the contribution to this integral from the saddle point. And so the saddle point contributes a half e to the minus 2z root pi over z. I'm just using that rho of I is 0, and rho double prime of I is minus 1, and using the formula from yesterday. So that's one contribution to the integral. But as was pointed out earlier, we do need to worry about the endpoints now, because the real part of rho is decreasing along in this direction. It's increasing along this direction. So there might be a significant contribution to the integral from this endpoint. And similarly over here, the real part of rho is increasing as we go towards the endpoint. So the integrand is certainly a local maximum along our contour at both of the endpoints. So we do need, in general, to worry about the contributions from the endpoints. And the method for figuring out what the contributions from the endpoints are relies on a generalization of the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. So let me just state some results from math. So the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma says that the integral of a to from a to b of f of t e to the I x t dt goes to 0 as x goes to 0, x goes to infinity, if integral a to b f of t dt goes to 0. So this is almost the kind of integral we're looking at. We've got this prefactor. But what we really want is a function of t in the exponent. Fortunately, there is also a math result that's generalization that we need. The generalization we need is that this integral is basically very similar to the ones we've been looking at. Goes to 0 as x goes to infinity if still need the integral of the absolute value of f to this should be finite. I already misspoke. This should also be finite in the same way. We also need psi to be continuous and differentiable. For a less than t less than b. And we also want psi t is not constant on any subinterval. Okay, so in that case, this integral goes to 0 as x goes to 0. Basically, the intuitive picture is that as x gets bigger and bigger, we have wilder and wilder oscillations, and we just get destructive interference. So that the integral goes to 0. So what we want to use, basically, is that we take this integral and we integrate it by parts. We can write this as minus 1 over ix integral from a to b times the derivative of f of t over psi prime of t e to the ix psi t dt plus f of t over ix psi prime t e to the ix psi evaluated at the boundaries. So if those things hold, we can integrate by parts, and it will be true that I of x will be asymptotic to f over I x psi prime of t e to the I x psi of t evaluated at the boundaries. Basically, this first term will go to 0 faster than the second term as x goes to infinity. If the above hold, and also f over psi is continuous and differentiable. And at least one of f of a over psi prime of a or f of b over psi prime of b is non-zero. Okay. So summary, the contributions from the endpoints basically will take this form as long as our function, our prefactor and the factor in the exponential have this ratio be non-zero at one of the endpoints, and they're not too badly behaved of functions. So we can just use this result then to figure out what the contributions at our endpoints are. So these conditions will be satisfied. At one of the boundaries, we'll have a non-zero contribution, and our f is 1, so that's a nicely behaved function, and our psi prime is just some polynomial, also nicely behaved. Okay. So we can use this result to evaluate the contributions from the endpoints. And so the endpoints contribute endpoints t equals plus or minus a half, plus or minus 1 gives a half e to the minus 2z, e to the z rho of plus or minus 1 over z rho prime of plus or minus 1. It's just using this formula and evaluating at the relevant endpoint. And plugging in, we get minus or plus I plus or minus 4 for 68z e to the 4 plus or minus I minus e minus 1z. So, so we have three contributions then to our integral. One from each of the endpoints, and one from the saddle point, which is at the top board up there. And so, in order to figure out which of these contributions is dominant, we need to look at when is the saddle point contribution much greater than the endpoint contribution. And to figure that out, we know what both of the contributions are. So the saddle point contribution is a half e to the minus 2z root pi over z. And this, to figure out when is this much greater than our endpoint contributions. As z goes to infinity. And this function is much greater than another function if the limit, as z goes to infinity, of e to the 4 plus or minus I minus 1 z over e to the minus 2z. These exponential factors will really control things. We could throw in the factors of z, but they would root z and z, but they won't affect it, whether or not the limit goes to 0. We can write this as the limit as z goes to infinity, e to the 2, 1, minus 1, plus or minus 2i, z is 0. So if this limit goes to 0, then the saddle point contribution is much bigger, much greater than the endpoint contributions. And if z is real, then we've got e to the minus 2z, which goes to 0. So this holds for z real. So we've determined that although the endpoints in principle can contribute, as long as we take z to infinity with no phase, then these endpoint contributions are negligible, or they don't contribute to the leading order asymptotic behavior.
Say that the first part of that was 0.
Here?
Yeah.
So that's this part.
Yeah.
So this generalization of the Riemann-Lebesgue integral lemma tells us that this integral goes to 0 as we take x to infinity. If we add these conditions, it can be shown that this goes to 0 faster than this term. So this will be a subdominant contribution. So if we're just looking at the leading asymptotic behavior, we can neglect this. I didn't show that, but that's the result. OK. So what happens if we give z a phase? Okay, so let's look through our derivation and see what will change. So if we give z of a's, then first of all, the imaginary part of, or the phase of the integrand will no longer just be the imaginary part of rho. If z has a phase, we'll also have to account for the phase of z. So the constant phase contours will change. Constant phase contours that pass through the endpoints and through our saddle points will change if we change the phase of z. So this, all of these contours will rotate and deform as we change the angle at which we take z to infinity. But as long as they, if they just change a little bit so that our contours still start on this endpoint, go through this saddle point, and then come to this endpoint, then our analysis will be unchanged. We didn't really care about the precise shape of the contours. We just cared what the endpoints were and what the saddle point was. So as long as our contour has the same endpoints and the same saddle points, the rest of our analysis holds. But if we look at our final result, let me write that down first. So for z, for the argument of z equals to 0, the I of z is asymptotic to 1/2 e to the minus 2z over root pi over z. But this last step depends on the argument of z. So z has a phase. Depending on the phase of z, this the limit of this exponential may go to 0 or may go to infinity. So could be the case that the end for some angles, the saddle point will be dominant over the endpoints, but for other choices, the endpoints will be dominant over the saddle points. And so, in fact, this works as long as the argument, the absolute value of the argument of z is less than the arctangent of 1/2. It's the condition we get for that. For this limit to be 0. On the other hand, if the argument of z is between pi and arctangent of 1/2, we get the t equals minus 1 endpoint will dominate. Since I minus 4 over 68z e to the minus 4 I plus 1z will be much greater than 1/2 e to the minus 2z I over z and also the other endpoint, the minus I minus 4 over 68z e to the 4 I minus 1z. So we have, as we change the angle at which we go to complex infinity or expansion parameter, we get an abrupt change in the behavior, the asymptotic behavior. So for z, z is in this range. The argument of z is in in this range, then we get this asymptotic behavior. If it's big enough, we get this asymptotic behavior. In the other case, this endpoint will dominate. So we see that there's an abrupt change in the asymptotic behavior as we change the phase. And so here, this was an exchange of dominance between the endpoints and the saddle points. Another possibility is that our contours will shift in a way so that it no longer goes through the same saddle points. And in fact, in this case, if the for the the argument of Z is greater than pi minus the arctangent of 2, then the contours will look like this. Constant phase contours. Will look like this. So it'll be something like that. And we can deform our original contour into a contour that connects the two endpoints without passing through either of the saddle points. So there'll be an abrupt jump in the which saddle points contribute. For this case, this jump occurs after the saddle point is no longer the dominant contribution. But in other cases, these abrupt jumps can occur when the saddle point that jumps on or off the contour is the dominant contribution. So for this case, there's no saddle point contribution. Yes.
Are the endpoint and the saddle point terms ever on the same board?
In this case, no. But you can construct examples where they'll be of the same order. That is possible.
Are you summing them then?
Then you would have to sum them. Or you could have multiple saddle points that are of the same order. You'd also have to sum them. That's possible. It doesn't happen all the time, but yeah. Any more questions on this? Okay, so our last topic, which is somewhat connected, but will be somewhat of a jump from before, is summation. I'll put in quotes of divergent series. My goal in this last part of our class is to convince you that it's not nonsense to assign a finite value to a divergent series, and it's not completely arbitrary, although we'll need some additional inputs in order to assign a finite number to a divergent series. And we're discussing this because, as we've seen, perturbation theory often yields asymptotic series which are divergent, not convergent. And even if those series are asymptotic, we're usually interested in a fixed finite value of the expansion parameter where the series diverges. Okay. So let's start by studying a simple example of a divergent series. known as Grandi's series, which is just 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1, etc. Okay, so this series is not convergent. The partial sums alternate between 1 and 0. And doesn't approach anything. So this is a divergent series because it doesn't converge. So that's what we mean by a divergent series. Some divergent series, we can also have a divergent series where partial sums grow without bounds. So this is another example of a divergent series. Here the partial sums just keep growing. What I mean by a divergent series is any series that doesn't converge. Okay, so what? Let's start by discussing what we're not allowed to do with divergent series before discussing what we can do with divergent series. So one thing we might try to do, because addition, you've all learned for many years that addition is associative, is we could try to take Grandi's series and insert a bunch of parentheses. So one thing I could try to do is write this as 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1, etc. And if I do all the indicated additions first, thinking of subtraction as just addition of the opposite, then I get 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0, which is a convergent series, and it converges to 0. So assuming that I'm allowed to use the associativity of addition, I can show that Grandi's series is equal to 0. I can also show, if I put the parentheses in slightly different places, I just leave the first one out and pair up all the other ones. I've got 1 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0. And this is also a convergent series that converges to 1. So if I assume addition is associative, I get this apparent contradiction. And so of course, addition is finitely associative. The way out of this contradiction is, what we should conclude from this example is that addition is not infinitely associative. We're only allowed to use the associative property of addition finitely many times. So this tells us addition is not infinitely associative. So one of our basic properties of addition, we need to put this caveat when we're talking about divergent series. Now, the other basic property we're used to for addition is commutative property of addition. And so one thing we can, so let's look and see whether we can derive a contradiction like this and whether or not addition is infinitely commutative. So you can write down the series expansion for log 2. It's just 1 minus a half plus a third minus a quarter plus a fifth, etc. This is a convergent series. This series converges to log 2. However, it's conditionally convergent. The sum of the odd terms diverges, as does the sum of the even terms. So if we take the absolute value of all the terms here, we get a divergent series. And let's just assume for a moment that we're allowed to commute the terms in the series infinitely many times. So if we are allowed to do that, I can make this series sum to pi instead of log 2. And to do that, I can write pi is equal to 1 plus a third, and just keep taking enough terms until I get something that's greater than pi. And then I can add negative terms. Until I get something less than pi, and so on. I can include all of the terms in the original series. I've just changed the order. If I just add up enough terms until I get greater than pi, then less than pi, if I go far enough, eventually I'll get closer and closer to pi. And I can make this series add up, instead of to log 2, to pi. Obviously, that's not something we want to happen. So what we should conclude from this is that addition is not infinitely commutative. So these are two things we're not allowed to do when we're manipulating divergent series, or even conditionally convergent series. Okay, so how can we assign a finite value to a sum to a divergent series? So adding them up. Sorry. Was there a comment?
Analytic continuation, maybe?
Yes, that's essentially what we're going to be doing. Yes. So we can't sum a divergent series by adding the terms. You can't manipulate the series by using associativity or commutativity infinite many times. So let's just try a few ways that we can try to make sense of divergent series and assign finite numbers to them. So the first one we'll look at known as Euler summation. And let's suppose we're interested in a divergent series of the form sum of an. And if these ans grow slowly enough, we can define a function f of x. That's just the same sum of a n x to the n. So if these grow slowly enough and x is less than 1, then this sum will converge for x less than 1 if a n grows slowly enough. So, and then we can define the Euler sum to be the limit as x goes to minus to 1 from below of f of x. This is one way we can assign a finite number to a divergent series. First, we make it convergent, and then we try to get rid of whatever we did to make it convergent. So let's apply this to Grandi's series. So 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 is sum from n equals 1 to infinity of minus n equals 0 minus 1 to the n. And then we get, for this example, f of x is then just the sum n equals 0 to infinity minus 1 to the n, x to the n. And this is just the Taylor series for 1 over 1 plus x. So the Euler sum is the limit as x goes to 1 from below of 1 over 1 plus x is half. So a half is seems like a reasonable number to get. The partial sums alternate between 0 and a half, zero and 1. So their average value, in some sense, is a half. So it's not an unreasonable answer to get, but this does seem like a rather arbitrary procedure. It's a reasonable objection to this. So let's try a different method. See what we get. So there's another method we can use. It's known as Borel summation. And the basic idea behind Borel summation is noting that n factorial is the same thing as gamma of n plus 1, which is, we've seen, the integral from 0 to infinity dt e to the minus t, t to the n. So we can write 1 as the integral of 0 to infinity dt, e to the minus t, t to the n for n factorial. And the idea behind Borel summation is if we insert the identity in this form, multiply each term in our divergent series by this identity, and then swap the sum in the integral, we get something that may be convergent. So the Borel sum is defined to be the integral from 0 to infinity dt e to the minus t times the sum from n equals 0 to infinity a n t to the n over n factorial. So this, if there wasn't the n factorial here, this looks like the Euler sum. Got an extra n factorial to make this even more convergent. So this will be finite for a broader class of divergent series than Euler summation. And so let's compute the Borel sum of Grandi series. So for an equals minus 1 to the n, we have that this sum of an t to the n over n factorial is just the sum minus 1 to the n t to the n over n factorial, which is just e to the minus t. Just the Taylor series for e to the minus t. And we get that the Borel sum is the integral from 0 to infinity dt e to the minus t times e to the minus t, which is a half. Integral of e to the minus 2t from 0 to infinity is a half. Precisely the same thing we got before. So maybe it wasn't quite as arbitrary as we thought. And in fact, it can be shown that these, whenever the Borel sum and Euler sum both exist, we'll always get the same result from both. So we do need some extra machinery in order to define, assign a finite number to a divergent series, but not at least completely arbitrary. And in fact, we can sum many divergent series without even specifying an explicit procedure like this. So here we've defined a explicit procedure for summing this series, so it seems like maybe we're inputting a lot of information. But if we just assume that our summation procedure obeys a few general properties, we can sum many divergent series. So let's define what I'll call a generic summation procedure. And call this procedure S. And what properties, so let's think about what properties we want our generic summation procedure to have. So one is we take the sum of a series. That should be the same as we take the first element of the series and add it to the sum of the rest. So that's certainly a property that convergent series obey. And that's a desirable property that any procedure we use to assign a finite value to a divergent series should have. It should, if we're in any sense of the term summing the series, it should probably obey a property like this, where we can take the first term and add it to all the rest. So that's it's in some sense a weaker form of associativity. Second property we'd like our summation procedure to obey is that it should be linear, in the sense that if we have two series and we take linear combinations of them, we should get the same thing as if we summed each of the series individually and multiplied them by the constants alpha and beta. So this is a linearity property. Again, satisfied by convergent series. So it doesn't seem like we're inputting a lot, but this is enough to sum Grandi series, for instance. To see how to do that, let's say S is equal to the sum of Grandi series. Well, if we use property number one, this is one minus the sum of, or one plus the sum of minus one plus 1 minus 1 is property number 1. And using property number 2, this is 1 minus the sum of 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1. So we're just pulling out a minus 1 from every term in the series. And we're allowed to do that using this property if we take, say, beta to be 0 and alpha to be minus 1. So this gives us 1 minus s. This is just our original sum. So s is 1 minus s, or s is a half. It's precisely the same thing we got before. So we do need a little bit more input, but it's not completely arbitrary, assigning finite numbers to divergent series. And the methods I presented here are just a few of the simplest methods. These have the advantage that they're simple and straightforward to apply. They have the disadvantage that they need all of the terms in the sum before the sum can be even computed approximately. In physics problems, if we run across divergent series, we may not be able to compute all of the terms in the series, but fortunately, there are other procedures like Euler summation or Borel summation. One is known as Bidet summation that can approximate the sum using only a finite number of terms in the divergent series. So, and when we're dealing with asymptotic series, a common case is that many asymptotic series that we'll encounter are divergent series, and often these asymptotic series best approximate the original function if we just truncate them after the smallest term. You can certainly construct counterexamples, but that's a case that occurs all the time. And even though these sums are divergent, they do, in a sense, approximate the original integrals. Any questions on divergent series? Yes?
So if we started with, like, I don't know, something like Stirling's approximation, right?
Yes.
We had an exact function, and then we turned it into approximate function. So if we sum that divergent series using one of these like generic summation procedures, can you prove that that'll give, like, is it like usually well known that it'll give you back the exact?
This going from an asymptotic series back to the original function is, that's an active area of research. There's some cases where you can do that. This is a branch of mathematics, and some of it's going over to physics called resurgence.
Okay.
So it's newer than all the stuff I've told you about, but there is active work there, and in some cases it can be done. Not in every, and well, maybe it's possible in every case, but it's not known how to do it all the time.
What is that other method you mentioned, the Bidet?
Bidet?
Outline it,
so the idea is you first combine the partial sums in a way that enables the It's basically a method of manipulating the partial sums in a way that converges to the this value, and it's going through the. I'd be happy to discuss the exact procedure outside of class, but it's. I'll just say that for now. Yes.
What are these kinds of results useful for?
These kinds of results. We often encounter divergent series in physics. One example that comes up is in one of the first ways that people computed the dimension of space-time in string theory. You ran across this infinite sum, divergent sum, 1 plus 2 plus 3, the sum of the positive integers. And in order to show that the dimension of space-time is 10 using that method, and for string theory, you need to make sense of that series using procedures like this. So that there's, since other methods that don't require that, but summing divergent series does come up fairly frequently.
I mean, the way I'm thinking about it now is we have this divergent series and we need some way of assigning a number to it, but
yes.
How do we know really that the number has any kind of physical meaning?
For physicists, the usual answer to that question is if you can do it in several different ways and you get the same results, you might have some trust in it, or you can compare it to experiment.
Okay.
For mathematicians, as I mentioned, there's a branch of mathematics that's trying to do things more precisely, but that's much more involved than I have time to talk about. Yes?
If you have two series that have like the same RL sum, does that tell you anything about them series?
The same partial sum?
Same
Euler sum. About the, well.
Does it tell you anything?
To the divergence?
Yeah.
Well, in the same way we can construct lots of different convergent sums, convergent series that converge to the same number, I think it wouldn't tell you a whole lot. If you could say that as a function of some parameter, it always converges, that probably would tell you more about two different series. But it tells you something. It doesn't tell you everything. Yes.
I have the same question, like any for the Stokes phenomenon. Do you have examples in physics where the Stokes phenomenon show up?
So Stokes. Stokes phenomenon occurs, for example, a very common technique in quantum field theory is we do what's called a Wick rotation, an analytic rotation in time, and sometimes, so we're taking, often we take the limit time goes to infinity, so we do a Wick rotation, we're taking time to infinity in a different direction than the complex plane, so we can run across something very analogous to this. Other questions? Okay, so we've talked about a variety of topics in this course, starting from distributions, got a few special functions, gamma and zeta functions, Green's functions, orthogonal functions, asymptotic series, loosely connected topics, so I won't try to tie them all together. I've seen a few incidental connections between them, but I hope you find what you've learned in this course useful over the rest of the year. Thank you.